Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we look at the possible futures that lay before humanity as artificial intelligence exponentially develops from present-day technology. This contemplation is through the lens of the science fiction short stories written by Judith Barry Baker in her recent book titled Letters to the Cyborgs. As humans become 51% machine or more, who will inherit the Earth? Short stories such as The Perfect Wife is now probable as articles of robot companions make front page news. We're told the singularity will occur by 2030. Well, interestingly, that's the date the United Nations has projected for the completion of the agenda for the 21st century. What types of futures are being envisioned for humans? And how are we being set up for a transhumanist agenda? Our guest, Judith Barry Baker, is a former cancer researcher with degrees in anthropology, English, and communications. She describes herself as a whistleblower, a futurist, a poet, and artist. She's a scientist who campaigns for a cure for cancer and as a witness who personally knew Lee Harvey Oswald. She seeks exoneration for Lee and justice for John F. Kennedy. Judith includes science fiction stories by Lee Harvey Oswald and a list of books Oswald read compiled by the FBI. Judith Baker joins us to talk more about her third book, Letters to the Cyborgs. Judith Baker, welcome to Another News.
Hello.
It's great to have you on the show, and I just want to mention before we get into the first question, we should let listeners know what the situation is, because you're not on an ideal connection right now. Can you let listeners know that you are in exile and you're traveling from place to place and you're currently in Europe?
Correct. I have to move every 90 days, actually, and I'm a person without a country, actually, because I spoke out back in 2000 about Lee Harvey Oswald being innocent, and there are more people alive then than now. And I ended up in having four so-called accidents in 5 years. It damaged my vision. I had concussions. I really feel sorry for Hillary Clinton because I know what it's like to have to recover from those things. I haven't had any incidents since moving overseas permanently in 2007. Although I have to move from place to place, I have to leave the EU every 90 days and stay away for 90 days. And part of that time I spend in the USA. And when I do, I have some protection.
Okay, thank you for that background.
Well, I have things to say that I'm probably the last living person who can tell you the full truth about Lee Harvey Oswald. And in the book, Letters to the Cyborgs, there's actually a short story by Lee in there. He wanted to write, in fact, you'll find that in the book, there's a section where this Fort Worth stenographer says that Lee Oswald came to her wanting to have her type out a book for him that was anti-communist. Now, you don't hear that in the media.
No, you don't. Well, it's great to have you on the show. This collection of science fiction short stories is a great read. I haven't been going in order, but instead selecting them based on titles. Can you give listeners an outline of this book, Letters to the Cyborgs, and why you wrote it?
Letters to the Cyborgs is a wake-up call to America and to the whole technological universe. We have a real problem in ethics today. Almost anything goes. It doesn't matter if we inject sheep with enough DNA so that they're 30% human. People don't seem to care or understand or notice what's going on. We can't trust our scientific reports, and because a lot of them are created by, like, Monsanto or some other big company to support whatever they're doing. The ordinary person hasn't the understanding. I was a nerd, I suppose you could say, but I was in cancer research, mm-hmm. and actually did cutting-edge research when I was only 18. I gave lung cancer to mice in only 7 days, and had done that in the big labs. Now, I had help from Oak Ridge and from Walter Reed and so on, and from with a lot of equipment and things, but still, I did that on my own. And I learned that if you think out of the box, that you can get a lot more done. Right now, it's kind of lockstep the way they do a lot of research. And for example, in cancer, the old idea of cut, burn, and poison is still number one, but we're starting to get into genetics. And, of course, they should have been there a long time ago, along with virus implementation, but they did not. I had been advocating bacteriophage research for years. Okay, so that's some of that, and I don't want to get too deep into that, except to say that all around us we have inventions that exist today, and I have taken these inventions as the base for these stories. In other words, everything that these stories are based on have a foundation on inventions that we have today.
Yes, they do, and I noticed that. It was very interesting.
Yes, and I put a lot of end notes and footnotes so that people can go and look them up. For example, if I told you that we have mice that glow in the dark, you've probably heard about that, right?
Right.
And perhaps you've heard about mice that are, you know, can be bred to be intelligent, have bigger heads. Also, we have mice now that have 30% or more human brain tissue in their little brains. They think they can get it up to 90%. As they have mentioned in discussing what kind of a mouse you would have at that point, that if it started acting like humans, that like a human might do, that they would destroy them. I don't think they would. And I see enslavement of animals if they have enhanced intelligence. And the other things, basically we're looking at moral problems because we don't have much morality right now. We have a situation where people are pretty frightened, actually. What if you lived in Aleppo, you know? And why can't you even get some trucks in there? Why can't they drop food from the air there? There are other ways and other solutions to problems that we have. But we have more violence, and we're using so much high tech. And on top of this is the hard part. We have so much surveillance going on, and I think you are very aware of that, that if we have any significant protests going on and someone wants to stop it who has a lot of influence, a lot of money, those protesters, that protester is going to be found and dealt with. Now, I say I'm in hiding and all that, but if I were important enough, I wouldn't be alive. So I'm not that important, but maybe I can surprise you, you see. Mm-hmm. And I have been surprising people.
Well, Judith, let's take a story out of your book, Letters to the Cyborgs. And the subtitle is, As Humans Become 51% Machine or More, Who Will Inherit the Earth? Airspace was the first one I read, and it's an important one. The idea that our natural resources can be intentionally poisoned, then sold back to us, is actually happening now. Soon they're going to tax the air, is an expression often heard. You went much further than that in this disturbing but possible scenario. Can you tell listeners about this story?
Yes, actually, the idea for it came 35 years ago. Richard Randall, a professor of anthropology, of course, I have a degree in anthropology and cultural and forensics, medical anthropology, and so on. So I'm interested in interaction between medicine and science, of course, and humanity, and how it impacts. Mm-hmm. The problem we are faced with now is that we're using our skies, our atmosphere, as a toilet. And how bad can it get? Well, if you just went back to London 200 years ago, when they were just throwing feces right out the window, all we've done is now, instead of throwing it out the window, we're throwing it into the oceans, basically. And of course, we have plastic, nanoparticles, and so on. Every time you eat a fish, you're eating little tiny pieces of plastic you can't even see, and they're lodging in your lung tissue, in your kidney tissue, and anywhere else where they can float through and get caught. We are loading ourselves up with all kinds of material. Now, the whole idea is that someone is going to make money making sure that you don't have to ingest or, in this case, inhale anything that you shouldn't. On the other hand, once the government is in charge of the air and you're living under a bubble, so to speak, what kind of influence can they have over what you think and what you're breathing? When we see what we have with vaccinations going on right now, that children are not owned by their parents anymore. They're not the sovereign masters of their children. It's the state saying you must take a vaccination. the time will come when you must smell the air, and it may not be roses.
You went as far as to describe one incident in this story. They medicated the air with tranquilizers as a tactic,
yes,
replacing rubber bullets to stop descent. Where did you get that idea?
Well, we have that already, as a matter of fact. We have aerosol-type materials that can be distributed through a crowd even now. There are many, many ways, of course, to handle situations. The best way is to find the right combination of drugs that can make people, for example, remember certain key words but not remember the wrong ones. Seriously, we are looking at what I call a boutique situation where they can create any kind of air they want with any kind of result that they want. And if it's piped into an auditorium or piped into a subway or whatever, they, for example, they could calm crowds that are panicking and so on. That's the good side, and they always show a good side. But on the other hand, they can calm you down so that you can never help to elicit change, and you won't protest anymore.
There was a concern here in New York City last year and the year before when they had told the population that there would be tests to monitor the release of poison gas, but they would release an inert gas and follow it in the way that it travels through the subway and disperses through tunnels, etc.
Of course, they're looking at potential terrorists doing that, naturally, sarin gas and so on.
People were concerned that usually when a drill is being conducted, it's usually a platform for a false flag operation to occur at the same time.
Well, bless your heart. You seem to be quite aware of what's really going on. Congratulations.
Well, a lot of the listeners are tuned in to this, and that didn't seem to be the case. But after reading Airspace, it made me think about it a little differently.
Well, you have to tweak the technology until you get it right, so you're going to make tests. The point is, of course, is that control of the masses has always been very, very important to anyone in power and how you do it. And we already have so many materials that are in so-called drinking water. In America, I can't even bear. I live in places where the water is clean, and it's a real imposition to have to try to drink some of the tap water in the United States. It's filled with chemicals. You can taste it. If you're not around it a lot, and really, it's an experiment in itself. I'd love to get some kits out, some chemical experiments done, and see just how many things you have in there. For example, we have a lot of female hormones running around from birth control pills in the water systems. And then they wonder why we have feminine-type males emerging. If you add any kind of hormones to the water supply of ordinary animals, you end up with hermaphrodites and all kinds of things. And then we're wondering why we have an emerging population. Now, I'm not saying that we've never had homosexuals or anything like that, but I'm saying that fetal development can be influenced by the hormones that are in the water supply.
Right, and that's scientifically proven in animals?
Oh, yeah. We can demonstrate that, especially like with frogs, toads, with polywogs. What kind of sex they'll turn out to be if you have enough hormone in the water.
Indeed, yeah, they're often the canary in the coal mine, as it were, for the health of an ecosystem.
Well, and what are we going to do? The point is if we can just wake up people enough. But now look what we have. We have this Monsanto deal with Bayer. This is a huge, enormous monopoly. They're already notorious for the kind of lack of concern about the long-term consequences of genetic splicing, GMO, and so on. I mean, we're throwing things on the market without understanding what it can do to the unborn. I mean, they don't take time to test anything that way.
Judith Baker, could you explain for listeners that deal with Bayer and Monsanto, if listeners are not familiar with it?
All right. Well, first of all, the easiest way to explain Monsanto is that their products are banned throughout much of Europe. Bayer has come under fire for all kinds of drugs that have turned out to have bad side effects. They've had to pull them off the market. I mean, fetal abortions here or six fingers there or whatever. What we're talking about is that these people at the top here are pretty careless about what they're doing. Monsanto basically is handling probably 20%, and that's a very modest estimate, of all the seeds that are available. They have worked it out, so, and this is the way it is for so many plants and grains right now. And you have to buy your grain from them. And if any pollen, for example, blows over and influences another field, and those seeds will be picked up by Monsanto, I mean, they will make sure that that farmer has to pay for them. As a spread of polluted corn, because it is polluted, I will not eat corn that's created in the United States of America. I will not. And just like I will not take a flu shot. A lot of people don't understand what we're looking at. But when we are creating something and the bottom line is money, then ethics go right out the window. And this is typical. This is human. This is the way people are. Unless somebody stands up and says, wait a minute, stop. Look what you're doing. Sometimes people will listen. We do have laws. We should have laws on monopolies. If this merger occurs, they will have more influence than any other company in the world on our food and pharmaceuticals that are connected to food. It's dangerous. They will have so much influence that it will be difficult for the EU, for example, to stop them from forcing people to buy their seeds. Those seeds are specially modified. In some cases, they will not even, you can't save them for another crop. They will not sprout. You have to buy new seeds from Monsanto. You've got to understand what we're talking about. We're talking about seeds that are modified. We do not know how well they've been tested. We do know, for example, from another source, we have an epidemic right now of cancer in golden retrievers and Labradors. And why them? Well, they're the ones that get more care, and there are more of them around, so that's they're noticed more. But we have never had such an influx of cancer before as we have now. And what's going on? Well, remember that when carcasses are condemned, they're condemned because a lot of them have cancers. If you could see what some of these cattle look like, they're all forced together to live together, and they pass diseases one from another, and of course, then they throw antibiotics at them and so on. They're overfed with grain, so they get very fatty. They're sick. They're sick animals, and they often develop cancers. And these cancers are cut off of the carcass, and you don't get to see those. Often I have seen cancers, though, in bacon and so on. And people just don't know. Breast cancer is very common among sows, and unfortunately, people are eating bacon, for example, that's filled with often with cancerous material from that breast tissue, which is what bacon is.
Ooh. So people are eating, unwittingly eating cancer cells.
Well, the point is that they're saying, well, you're not going to get cancer from eating cancer. Well, I beg to differ with you. We have cancer running through families. How does that happen? We have any time that a virus that's being carried that causes cancer can cause a genetic flux, a change in your system. Where does that virus come from? You know, a lot of viruses can be cooked, and it doesn't bother them at all. Mm. In the case of animals, these dogs, we have so many of them being fed on cancerous tumors that have been ground up as, you know, they call it crude protein. The crude means it can be feathers, it can be hair, it can be hooves. So the crude protein is a very poor way to measure something that's half of that time they can't even digest it. On the other hand, what they do get in the way of meat is often so contaminated, and cooking is not going to kill a lot of these viruses. So I see a connection that never used to exist before about these condemned carcasses and so on with the terrible sufferings of wonderful animals, and these are often companion dogs and so on. This is just one example. We in this country in America also often raise, like, for example, swine together. I mean, they can't even turn around. They're kept in such horrible conditions. I think actually it's, I would call it a sin to eat pork in America. I won't eat it in Denmark either. And I don't see anything wrong with eating animals per se. They've coexisted with us, and you can even say that we have a relationship with them over time that we've developed, and they're perfectly happy being raised and killed by us. If they were in the wild, they'd be killed by wolves, you know, ripped to pieces. So it's not that part of it that's so bad. What's bad is when we inflict terrible conditions on animals so that they have no decent life just to make a profit. So, you know, your caged chickens with their beaks cut off and so on. This is going to come back to haunt us, because these animals, when they're pushed together like that and they're ill, they're being pumped with antibiotics and so on, they have viruses that they can easily transfer one to the other. And if they have a weird new virus, we have no idea whether it'll, you know, pass over and affect us. We're just playing with fire, and we deserve to get burned. So those are just some of the ideas. And mostly in the letters to the cyborgs, I'm talking about the consequences that really come from wanting to make a profit. When you have that bottom line, we have to choose a profit over somebody's health or somebody's comfort. In one of my stories, something goes wrong, and they're using floating islands because there's no more room anymore on the surfaces that go a couple hundred years in the future, like 300 or 400 years in the future.
That's happening here in New York.
Yes, where they're building these platforms now because of the rising sea levels. Well, the idea is, what if it's in algorithms, and by the way, the story, which you may not have read, algorithms is about the commands that are given to robots, and if cyborgs are infested with robotic thinking. Cyborgs now, remember, came from living tissue originally. They were humans, for example. Almost all of us already have cyborg elements. If you have a metal knee, if you have a titanium hip, if you have a titanium jaw, whatever. So we're well on our way. We have artificial parts already, you know, plastic lenses in case you have to take the one out of your eye that is getting a cataract and so on. Mm-hmm. The time is coming when we will see that people will prefer to be replaced, have parts of them replaced so they don't feel pain anymore, or they won't feel as much, you know, they'll have senses. Or they can uplift their senses, or they can run faster, and on it goes, until finally you're, like in algorithms, people who are working, and if they're robotic, and that is, they have learned, and we're already to the stage where they only have like 15 minutes downtime every 24 hours, because that's all they need because of the chemicals being pumped into them now. And in other words, just like they're not allowing people to retire at age 65, they've moved it up to 70, basically. And if longer we live, it'll go up to 100 if we end up living to 120 and so on. So all the time we push that envelope, and people often are working and overworked. You know, they have 2 35-hour jobs because they can't get health insurance. They have to have 2 jobs. They're working 70 hours or more, and that doesn't count coming to and from work. We have enslavement going on like I haven't seen since, well, I read about it, and I've never seen anything like what's happening now. And the fact that most people in comfortable positions are not seeing this. I walked past a couple who were sitting at together, and he had a cast on his leg, and I sat and talked to them, and they were crying. I said, well, what's the matter? He said, well, we've worked so hard, and he broke his leg, and that used all our money up, and now we can't have any children. We can't afford it. And they had just come to the realization that to be good parents, they didn't dare have a child, because one incident completely crashed their bank account and their ability, because he lost his job. Oh. He lost his job because his leg was broken. It was broken on the job. This kind of cruelty that's going on, cruelty. As we become less religious, I don't care what your religion is, if a religion teaches compassion, patience, and so on, who's teaching compassion, patience, and love to our children now?
Judith, was that in Europe or the U.S.?
That was in America. Hmm. I have to say that there are people are not working as hard and they're happier. People, it's true. Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, Iceland, and the Netherlands, and even parts of Germany. Free medical care, my friends. They have cancer. They don't lose their home and everything they have. Or they don't get kicked out when they run out of money and say, we can't do any more for you. They get cured of cancer for free, for heaven's sakes. My friend George had stomach cancer, and he was in the hospital 6 weeks. I asked him, George, how much did it cost you? Sweet, okay? He said it cost him $1.25 a day, and that was to rent the TV set. Free medical care, except for a small payment you make. So, there's a yearly payment you have to get through first. Like, that stops you from going to the doctor every 5 minutes. Free college education. You get a year in Sweden off. If you're a dad or a mom, they both get a year off to take care of their newborn. And that year can stretch out to 18 years. That is, they can break it up to the age of 18 of that child to be with them when they're sick or whatever and take time off and still have pay coming in. Sure, their taxes are a little higher, but when you add up all the horrible hidden expenses we have in the United States, there's no difference except our people are suffering. The highest cost for medical care in the world and not the best care. So I was in Slovenia just a week ago in Bratislava. They're ranked higher in their medical care systems than the United States, and their people get in there for free. One of the governments, you see, since they have to pay for it, they're very interested in keeping costs low, and that doesn't mean that their people are in trouble. They're not, because they actually can vote. They have 5 or 6 parties, typically. You have 60, 70, 80% voter turnout. And the result is that they have a working democracy. It's called a social system, but it's really social democracy. Those are nasty words in America. You can't say the word socialism right away. They say, oh, communism. And I see so much suffering in my country. Dear God. This book is a wake-up call.
One of the stories is titled Little Green Men, and it references genetically altered humans and chimeras. Designer humans, essentially. Can you talk a little bit more about that? You were speaking about genetically modified animals and plants, but we're talking about humans.
Yes. We are now able to, by hooking people up to enough electrodes and all that, we can actually determine when they're going to think of something before they know it, as we have proven, you know. The computer already has detected the choice they're going to make before they know it, because the brain has worked that fast and hasn't gotten to the other parts of the brain to make it aware of the decision. In other words, right now, we're right on top of the cusp of being able to understand if someone is lying or not. In my stories, I'm saying that they can reconstruct personalities. One of the personalities I have in there is like Mother Teresa has been injected into this person's brain. For example, you could have Mother Teresa along with Sylvester Stallone. You could have any kind of personality you want that are mixed together, that these designer personalities to obtain the kind of person you want. We could have, say, Bruce Willis, for example, personality to be a bodyguard. Everywhere you look, you've got someone who was born with a brain, but they were transmuted into a particular personality. And, of course, they can make them in any way they want. We're not talking about eye color anymore. We're talking about the way humans think and the way humans will behave and who they are. And, of course, we're looking at the fact that rebels and oddballs and anybody who's autistic, unless they think that's worth something, anyone who might be considered dangerous, or shall we say they could even breed dangerous people to be used to control others. All of this is on our doorstep. On our doorstep. And it's not fun to watch how people are accepting these things, because they're watching, they're doing a lot of video games and so on. They're becoming, I would say, hardened to the fact that these changes are coming. Well, it's not going to happen to me. Well, what about your children? Well, people aren't caring about their children very much anymore. Our future, frankly, every advanced country, the birth rate goes down. the birth rate is high where you have religion, whether it's Muslim or Catholic or whatever, because they have, frankly, a belief that they're supposed to be on the earth and that they're supposed to be thriving and they're there because of God's will or whatever you want to call it. We don't have that anymore. We have the ideas of population control. Ask yourself, why are they vaccinating people in Africa and in India instead of teaching the women to just take birth control pills? If these women had control of their bodies with birth control with pills, which are so cheap, do you think they would be having little kids, little babies that are starving to death because they cannot squeeze another drop of breast milk from their tissues because of they're starving themselves? And that maybe their baby came from raping. That happens so often. We can talk all we want about vaccinating for disease and pumping food into these areas, but if we don't give women choice so that they can have some control over their reproductive life, then we're going to continue, like Jesus said, we will always have the poor with us, you know. And I love people, but I see the foolishness. Is it right that we wage war in order to keep populations down?
These are very important questions to sit and think about deeply. And preparing for this interview with you, I had collected a list of various headlines.
Go for it. Let me hear them.
It's in our face every day, so I'll just go down a short list here. Parents' smartphones harming children's ability to hold conversation, say teachers. That's one. Cloning could lead to an illegal black market. That's another.
Absolutely.
Intelligent robots could be running your company within 10 years, experts warn. Technology is destroying our inner lives. The mad scientist will clone 100,000 cows. China clone factory scientist eyes human replication. Artificial intelligence machine gets testy with its programmer. Spearheaded by...
Yeah, that artificial intelligence, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
And self-awareness really has already been achieved. They don't talk about it very much. The chances that we are going to be in charge of our own destiny are slim.
Here's another one. Spearheaded by flood of wearable devices, a movement to quantify consumers' lifestyles is evolving into big business with immense health and privacy ramifications. I'm hopeful on this one because of the Google Glass issue. Now, there are a couple stories. I noticed wearable tech isn't inevitable as Google thought, and you have the camera and the phone and streaming video on a pair of glasses linked to the web, and there's facial recognition and everything. And here are a few headlines from 2014 that are kind of hopeful. Techstar, I want to punch anyone wearing Google Glass. I was assaulted wearing Google Glass. Business Insider. Here's another one. Google Glass assault. Tech writer Sarah Slocum accosted up in bar for wearing high-tech Google Glass. Here's another one. The unwearable wearable. Google Glass is brilliant and loathsome.
The problem is we're not going to have these where people can see them. We're going to have implants. We're going to have holograms so you don't actually have to feel any of this. In fact, the time will come when people will be walking along and they'll be seeing something that may not really be there. One of my stories is called The Perfect Wife. Remember when they said cable TV, you know, pay TV, that way we won't have any commercials on it? Of course, that didn't last, and that's human nature. Now, when we talk about the ability for companies and techs to actually invade human thoughts, in that story, of course, I talk about that he has to pay in order to not be able to remember the ads that are being barraged at him while he's sleeping, and so on. We don't have proper oversight, and we're way behind in thinking about how to handle the psychology that will be used to influence us to buy and to sell and to act as herd animals. We love being herd animals. We love it. We love being at a football game and screaming our heads off and swaying back and forth. We feel united, you know, with a great clan. And every time you see a kid working on a text, you know, doing texting, This is their family now. That's their family.
I could see that happening. I just want to add in, just to connect back to the Google Glass for a second.
Yes.
Like the Verichip, it didn't go away. A company in Paris took over the design work of Google Glass, and it will probably try to make a comeback, a sneaky comeback, as you reference. There seems to be a distinct boundary here in terms of how much privacy can be invaded.
My friend, that concept, just like the atomic bomb, our privacy, as they say over here, has been invaded. It has been decimated. It has been corrupted, and it's a concept. It doesn't actually exist anymore. The invasion of privacy has extended again. That if we're told to get a vaccine, we better do it, and if we're told that we can walk around, but we have to have an anklet around our leg saying where we are. I'm telling you, the day is coming when everybody will have one. If you're good, it doesn't matter if you have an anklet on. Of course, it won't be an anklet. It'll be some kind of, it'll be a little tiny, you won't feel it, little dot under your skin. You know, they'll tell everywhere where you are. And of course, they'll start with saying children. That way we can find our children.
Oh, yeah. It's often justified through security or
because
your health.
Yes, fear is the great tool that's being used. And frankly, without the courage that we need, you know, the only thing that can really stop all this, I'm going to tell you, it's a four-letter word, love. Love is the only thing that can fight this. Love of people, love of privacy, and respect for others, that we have got to get that back. I hope it's not too late.
Well, Judith, love requires strength. And love requires people standing up against this level of
sure, and they're full
tyranny.
Of tranquilizers, they're full of drugs, and they're full of all kinds of directives. They don't even know what they're getting over TV sets. You do not know all the messages that you're... I'm going to give you a subtle example. I'm not advocating Trump. I'm not advocating Clinton or anything. But when I watched Amanpour on CNN today, and... she was talking to someone from Russia, and she was saying how bad Trump was because apparently he wants to get along with Putin, you know. Behind her, she has Hillary Clinton shown on a big screen waving and smiling and all that. Well, that is a subliminal message. You know, choose Clinton. She's nice and she's smiling and she's not scary. And this manipulation has been going on for a long time with so-called news channels and all that. We don't have what we used to have. We used to have actual reporters. We had brave people. And yeah, sometimes they got in trouble. I see that you are sticking your neck out. I'm very surprised, and I'm kind of thrilled about it, actually. Unfortunately, you're aware that the media itself, in general, is pretty well locked up and tied up, and people have to basically say what they're told to say, and it's becoming blatant. They don't even try to hide. They're not trying to be fair anymore.
Right.
This is a pattern that's going to increase. And if you read 1984, that you see that we're just right around the corner from that.
It is disturbing, but I'm for some reason I'm still hopeful.
Well, this is a wonderful thing. You're hopeful because you know that basically people are good. Can we find leaders who will survive long enough? The problem we have now is that because of surveillance and because of the technological advances, it's hard for a leader to get together any group that's significant enough to make a difference. And frankly, I love them and I trust many. Our future is bleak. It really is.
It definitely is.
Nobody's going to buy the book because... they're going to feel... actually, I put a lot of humor in the book.
Yeah, there's a lot of humor in this book, listeners. I just want to add in beautifully written science fiction, and you include the writings of Lee Harvey Oswald in your book, Letters to the Cyborgs. Tell listeners, if you would, about your relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald, and was he different from the person depicted in the FBI reports?
Definitely. And it's ironic. He worked... for the FBI, he was getting $200 a month. I can confirm it. He also was working with the CIA. A lot of people don't understand why this man was shot only 47 hours after he was taken into custody. He was buried the same day as Kennedy had with, they had a hard time finding anyone who would speak at his grave. Newspaper reporters are the ones who took his coffin to the gravesite, and they were smiling. We have pictures of them laughing and smiling. They're glad he's dead. That's how deep the instructions went to make sure that this man got demonized. I loved him. He taught me to respect and care about John F. Kennedy. I came from the University of Florida, where my friends were anti-Castro and they hated Kennedy. It's a long story, but to make a long story short, I had been trained very specifically in cancer research, and they were putting together an attempt to try to kill Castro yet another time, and I was involved in that. Lee Oswald was there to pretend to be pro-Castro in New Orleans so that anyone who may have come as a spy from Cuba to spy on ways that they were trying to figure out to kill Castro, that he could help to anticipate and to identify them. So when you see Lee Oswald handing out flyers that say hands off Cuba, and what you don't know is that any Latino who took a flyer like that and contacted Oswald or the phone number that he gave or the address, went to that address, they were interrogated, and I know one of them was beaten up, and drugs were planted on him, and he was sent back to Cuba. So Lee was involved at the height of the Cold War as a spy when he went as a fake defector over to the USSR. He had been trained to resist hypnosis and brainwashing. This is very important because they saw what happened in the Korean War. And I'm talking about this because when Lee came back, this defector wasn't arrested, unlike others. He wasn't fined or jailed, and he had a Soviet wife with him, for heaven's sakes. This man had so much intelligence, and he had dyslexia, so when he wrote things, it's kind of funny, he had made many spelling errors, but he was an excellent writer in so many ways. He was only 23 when I met him, and I was 19, and both of us wanted to write. He had such ideas in his head. He loved science fiction. He saw that as a template for possible futures, and so did I. So we got along so well. I also could speak some Russian, admired the Russian literature and so on. Lee was a fascinating person. There are many evil and ugly stories out there about him. For example, on the day he was arrested, there was a sack up on the sixth floor with chicken bones in it, and there was a pop bottle there, and they said that in the, you know, on the newspapers and everything like that, they said that he had been up there coldly and calmly eating lunch just before shooting Kennedy's head off. Fact of the matter was, that was somebody else's lunch up there. But in the meantime, there was a call to pump Lee Oswald's stomach to prove that he had been such an evil man. So here I am standing there, standing forth and saying that this man who has been considered one of the most horrible people in America was nothing of the kind, that he had actually infiltrated a group that part of it began there in New Orleans, and it spread. All of it is outlined in my book, Me and Lee, how I came to know, love, and lose Lee Harvey Oswald. I still love him. I will never forget him. I will never let him. To my dying breath, I'm not going to let him get away with it. It just isn't true.
Well, Judith, it's very important that you come out with this information. And you include a science fiction story written by Lee Harvey Oswald titled Her Way. And I'm curious, why did you put that in? Because it's very interesting.
First of all, this story shows that Lee had a sense of humor. It showed that he had writing ability. I had saved it all these years. We had both wanted to be published writers. He was more interested in social sciences than I was. He wanted to predict the future. I have proof and evidence, of course, in the book that he was taking out a lot of science fiction books. This story shows that he, although he had an unusual turn of mind and very strange ways of expressing himself, there's nothing evil or nasty or rotten or ugly about his writing or his thinking. And, of course, I saved and treasured these pages. for over 40 years. And I wanted him to get published right with me, because originally we were going to put our science fiction stories together and publish them.
Judith, you include a reading list of Lee Harvey Oswald, which there's a lot of books, and he must have been a fast reader. Plus, as you mentioned, he was very fluent in Russian very quickly. I'm impressed by the reading list. Can you talk more about that?
That's just one summer, and that doesn't even include books that he took out from the main library. That's just from the Napoleon Library. Lee loved to read. So did I, and I was a speed reader. He could read pretty quickly. What I found fascinating is his selections. Oh, well, I'll give you an example. The FBI said, look, he took out this book called Conflict. Mm-hmm. They don't tell you that the name of the whole thing is Conflict, the history of the Korean War, for heaven's sake. One of those books that was considered a right-wing attitude, a direction. And that's what you'll find in his readings. He read Ben-Hur. They only put Ben-Hur. The whole title is Ben-Hur, A Story of the Christ. Well, they don't want him to look like he had any interest in Jesus Christ, so of course the FBI didn't put the whole title on. But they did put the whole title when it had to do with the assassination, or if it was a story of Mao or whatever, any of the books that looked negative. Like they said, What We Must Know About Communism, they put that on there, the whole thing. You know, they didn't just call it communism or whatever. What they don't tell you is that J. Edgar Hoover, on the inside page, praises the authors of this book, What We Must Know About Communism. Now, that's the other part of it. Why in the world would he check out a book like that when he had been reading about communism since he was 12 and a half? And by the way, not only communism, he was also reading Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and all the Founding Fathers' works and Leviathan and so on when he was so young. He was an intelligent young man. Boy, even as a boy. But here we're looking at what he's reading, and his reading is just vast in the horizons. There's one book about everyday life in ancient Rome. It's a handbook used by anthropologists and archaeologists. So he was intelligent and interested in a wide variety of subjects. God bless him. He didn't live long enough to do very much, but how much he did accomplish at only age barely 24 when he died. He did save Kennedy's life in Chicago. When I first spoke out in 1999, that Lee told me he believed he'd saved Kennedy's life a few weeks earlier, nobody would listen to me. But now we have Abraham Bolden. That was the first black Secret Service agent on the Kennedy detail. Kennedy picked him out himself. When he tried to tell people that the Secret Service had been derelict in their duty and had been really very careless with Kennedy, they framed him, and he ended up in prison. It's horrible what happened to Abraham Bolden. He is going to be speaking at the JFK assassination conference that's going to be held in Dallas on the 18th, 19th, and 20th of November. We have 35 speakers coming in. They're from all over the place, some from overseas. We have 5 new witnesses. A lot of them are supporting my story. And what's important when I say that Lee helped to save Kennedy's life, we know Abraham Bolden was present in Chicago, because that's where they transferred him before all this bad stuff happened. He was present when the FBI called the Secret Service and said, stand down, Kennedy's not coming. Well, why isn't he coming? Well, we've arrested some armed men. A person named Lee gave us the information we needed. That was Lee Oswald. So you can imagine how much I appreciate Abraham Bolden and his courage. He told James Douglas in the wonderful book, JFK and the Unspeakable, right, about this. And he will be speaking at that conference. Now, he's elderly. We're just very grateful that he's coming. So we are looking at a young man who had actually infiltrated and risked his life. We know from other sources that on his 24th birthday, which was the 18th of October of 1963, he started to cry. Now, I'm going to tell you about two things about his crying. He started to cry, and his wife and the friend, Ruth Payne, who had made this little cake, said, "Why are you crying?" He said, "This is the last birthday I'll ever have." He was already in so deep. And I was aware of this. You have no idea the heartaches we went through, because by risking his life like this, he knew they were going to kill him. You can see on YouTube when they say that they are charging him with the murder of John F. Kennedy, just look at his face. Look at the shock on his face. And of all the things that he could have imagined, that he would be charged with the murder of the one man that he had risked his life to save and would die for. This is the Oswald that nobody hears about, so they have to make him look as ugly and nasty and rotten as they possibly can. I'm telling you, it's a terrible disservice that we do not have justice for John F. Kennedy. We have so much proof and evidence now. Oh, I was going to tell you about one other thing. It's on record. When little Patrick Kennedy died, little baby that was born several weeks early and had Hyaline lung disease, he couldn't breathe properly through undeveloped lungs, and oxygen wasn't helping, and he died. Lee Oswald, his wife, Marina, who had no reason to, she said other things about him that were absolutely distressing. She said he found out about it, and he broke down and cried. Now, do you think that man could have possibly, it's impossible that he would have shot at Kennedy. Of course, I've worked very hard, and others have too, to prove it was absolutely impossible from every aspect.
These are extremely important details. To put in context here, this event coming up in November, will you be attending?
Yes, I will be there. I will be speaking about the Lee Harvey Oswald I knew. We're also going to bring in the most wonderful speakers. We have Shane O'Sullivan coming in from London, for example, to talk to us about Robert F. Kennedy and the fact that Sirhan Sirhan was denied parole. He's being played up as the assassin of Robert Kennedy, when in fact he was standing in front of Robert Kennedy, and the bullet that killed Kennedy came from behind, in the back of his head. So these are the absurdities, and they're all over Lee Oswald's case. If you think that's odd, you ought to see what they've done with Lee. I mean, there's no possible way that he even owned. I never saw a rifle. And on top of that, this rifle was supposed to have been wrapped in his little girl's baby blanket, her favorite blanket, sitting in the garage for 2 months, stepped on, moved, and yet the blanket is pristine. It has nothing on it, not a shaving, even though there were wood shavings all over the floor there. There's not one speck of wood shaving on it. Mm. And it was tied up on the end. Lee Oswald was trained as a Marine. He joined the Marines when he was only 17. Wow. Wikipedia took my biography away. You know why they took my biography away?
No.
Well, because I and a friend, Alan, went to the Wikipedia site, and we saw that they said that Lee Oswald had dropped out of school, and then he did this, that, and the other. They don't say that he dropped out of school to join the Marines. They just said he was a high school dropout. And then we noticed that they never said that he got his GED while he was in the Marines, which he did. So we put in one sentence, we put in there, in the Marines, Oswald earned his GED. In 3 minutes, it was gone. And a few days later, my biography, because I'm a writer, I'm an author, I'm an artist, a poet, my paintings sell all over the world. A few days later, they said that I was nobody, and that, you know, I was only in that documentary on the History Channel, even though I'd been on many others. And they removed the biography that had been there for 5 years.
Oh, wow.
It's gone. You cannot find me on Wikipedia, even though I had 80 interviews last year.
Well, Judith, that's an interesting testament to who's controlling Wikipedia. And again, you can point right to the intelligence agencies that are continuing to control the dialogue here, the narrative of these events. And it seems like so much work to cover up lies and deception requires a lot of money and time and energy. And with people like you that bring this information forward, it's extremely important. I just want to tell listeners again, we've been speaking with Judith Very Baker, the author of many books, but this one we're talking about is Letters to the Cyborgs, the subtitle, As Humans Become 51% Machine or More, Who Will Inherit the Earth? Is there anything you would want to let listeners know in terms of how to reach you, how to contact you, and what's coming up?
Well, an easy way, of course, is to just go to jfkconference.com. Our tickets are selling. We will probably sell out. I talked about just one person coming to the filmmaker for JFK Must Die. We're also going to have Dr. Cyril Wecht, the number one forensic expert, who was the first one to object to the magic bullet. We have Jim Mars, who will be coming, and we have a number, Roger Stone will be there. Roger does not want anybody to think that Nixon did it, so he's very anxious to make sure that everybody understands who Lyndon Johnson was. And I lived in Texas for 20 years, so I can tell you I know how that Lyndon Johnson was involved. That's one reason they got rid of the love affair, because Lee said one of his last words were that, don't forget the name David Atlee Phillips, and don't forget Bobby Baker and Billy Celestes. We're going to have a gentleman there who was the lawyer for Billy Celestes and who can tell us a great deal more. And we're also going to have Barr McClellan, who can tell us all we ever need to know in that area. We've got 35 speakers. Five of them are new witnesses, never have been before have spoken. Some of them are supporting what I've said. It's finally coming out. And God bless them for it. For example, one woman has saw Lee Oswald at Mary Sherman's apartment building in the whole city of New Orleans. How was he there? Well, I said in my book, of course, he was there often. And she said she saw him there often. She's going to be speaking. We have so many new witnesses to prove that we're telling the truth and that we want the people to know the truth is going to win out. Another way to reach me is on Facebook, Judith Baker, J-U-D-Y-T-H Baker. I don't accept everybody, but, you know, you have to make a request. I never ask for donations. I live on donations, but I have to say that. But the point is I never ask for them. I feel that if people feel it in their hearts, they'll do it. And I'm not going to worry about it. And God will take care of me. I really believe that He has kept me alive. I know a lot of people don't believe in God, and I used to be an atheist, so I understand their positions. Mm. But I'll tell you one thing. As long as I have breath, I'm going to tell you the truth, and you can count on it. Ask me any question, and I probably can answer it, because the other blessing I've been given is I have a very good memory. 60 Minutes was fascinated with that, and they actually did a study after talking and working with me on people with these kind of memories where, unfortunately, you walk along and I get lost going around the corner. Why? Because my mind has already counted 56 panes of window, see, in the building where I just turned the corner on. Too many details that go into my head, but unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand that. How did I do this? Lots of research? No.
I want to thank you again for being on In Other News. It's just been a delight to speak with you, and I hope to have you back on the show to talk more about your work, because it's highly relevant, and the material that you're getting into here with your book, Letters to the Cyborgs, is extremely important. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit InOtherNewsRadio.com for archives of the show.